From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, John Waters. There's a new retrospective of his art, photographs, and more. Waters set new lows in bad taste with such films as Pink Flamingos, in which drag queen Divine plays a criminal whose title as the filthiest person alive is threatened when she gets a disgusting package in the mail.
Happy birthday, fatso! You are no longer the filthiest person alive. We are. Signed, the filthiest people alive.
Oh, just as I thought. And a deliberate attempt to seize my title.
We'll listen back to our interviews with John Waters.
I always like the villains. I love the stepmother. I love the Wicked Witch. So in all my movies and all my photographs, really, there is no such thing as a villain. The ingenue is the villain.
Also, I'll review Matt Weiner's new series, The Romanoffs. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not panic, but scream! Scream for your lives! The tingler is loose in this theater, and if you don't scream, it may kill you. Scream! Scream! Keep screaming! Scream for your lives! It's here! It's over here!
Ladies and gentlemen,
the tingler has been paralyzed by your screaming. There is no more danger. We will now resume the showing of the movie.
That's Vincent Price in a scene from The Tingler, directed by William Castle. Castle's low-budget shock and hype made him a hero to today's guest, screenwriter and director John Waters. Waters started his own filmmaking career, setting new lows in bad taste, most notably with the cult classic Pink Flamingos. His film Hairspray, which was adapted into a hit Broadway musical, was an affectionate and funny homage to the teen dance shows he used to watch in Baltimore. Last Sunday, the Baltimore Museum of Art opened a major exhibit devoted to John Waters, running through January 6th. It's called John Waters, Indecent Exposure, and is the first major retrospective of his visual art in his hometown of Baltimore. A companion catalog has been published, compiling not only visuals from the works and photos of John Waters, but also from other works that inspired him. John Waters has been a frequent guest on Fresh Air. In 2004, Terry interviewed him about an exhibition at New York's New Museum of Contemporary Art. It was a photographic series Waters began in the early 90s. Many of the photographs were tributes to his favorite films, which, not surprisingly, include many old exploitation films and tawdry melodramas. Most of the pieces Terry asked John Waters about in 2004 also are included in the new exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Art, including a photographic sequence from the movie Peyton Place. He told Terry why that film means so much to him.
Peyton Place was the first dirty book I ever read. I love Grace Natalia.
How dirty was it? I've never read the book.
The V of Betty's Crotch.
Uh-huh, okay.
About that dirty. But in 1956, that was pretty dirty. And, it's a great... You ought to read Peyton Place. There's many sequels to it. It opens up, Indian Summer is like a woman. That's the first line. But Grace Metellus, you know, has that famous author shot of her in the lumber jacket and the dirty ponytail sitting at the typewriter. And I was so obsessed, I even went to her grave. I went in her house where she wrote the book. But Peyton Place itself, when the book came out, I remember the ad campaign is, how did they make a movie out of Peyton Place or something like that. But whenever they got to a sexual scene, they would cut to a cutaway shot of symbolism, like if someone was frigid, they'd have a frozen lake, or if somebody was getting turned on, they'd show a blossom in spring. So it was all corny nature shots, and it looks like bad National Geographic shots, but actually it's dirty shots. It's what they couldn't show then. So I tried to concentrate on what was thought of as sexy then, and to show today how ludicrous, but maybe even sexier if you don't see it, because we're so used to seeing everything today.
When you were growing up and you started to watch films passionately, who were your first favorite movie stars?
My first favorite movie stars? I guess Elvis Presley. You know, I liked directors when I was young. I liked William Castle. I liked Kroger Babb, the one that they told us we'd go to hell if we saw his movies.
Who's
where
that?
He did Mom and Dad. He showed The Birth of a Baby for the first time. And he was a carny. He later even made a movie called One Too Many that he only showed at AA meetings, which I really like. That's a new kind of exploitation that I'm all for. I'm a carny too, basically.
What are the movies that you used to watch over and over again as a kid on TV or going to the movies time and time again to see it?
Yes, certainly. The Tingler, all the William Castle movies. And I did a piece in the show that shows William Castle's face. No, it shows William Castle's face, and then it has Alfred Hitchcock next to him, because everybody accused William Castle, who was king of the gimmicks in his films, of ripping off Alfred Hitchcock. But in a way, it was the other way around, because Alfred Hitchcock, people forget, when Psycho came out, the big ad campaign was that no one can enter the theater once the feature has begun, which was unheard of at the time. You forget. People used to go to the movies at any time and just stay through to the next part of the film. They never cleared the theater. So there was a clock in every box office, so you'd know, and it was a big, big gimmick. So in a way, he was king of the gimmicks also, and he copied William Castle, who in a way did it first. So I've always, in a way, liked the second rate better. I mean, William Castle I liked more than Alfred Hitchcock, Jane Mansfield, I liked more than Marilyn Monroe. Salminio, I liked him really a lot, though. I didn't feel he was inferior, but he was maybe, I liked Salminio even more than James Dean. I always liked the wrong person. I always rooted for the wrong person, and I always thought that the people that other people thought were ugly were better looking. That's always been my life, and my career has kind of been based on that.
I know you really like the carny pitch for a movie like the William Castle, come on. But were there movies right. that you felt really cheated by because they promised, like, sin and sex and sleaze, and they didn't deliver?
I never feel cheated when I go to the movies. Even if I hate it, it's an experience. It's a cinematic experience. And that's why I started taking these pictures. There's no such thing as a bad movie. If you go to a movie watching detail only, if you really hate the movie, just look at the lamps in it and pretend the movie is about lamps. And then never is it boring. It's always exciting and it's always surprising. You can even see continuity mistakes within the lamps.
You also have a series called Inga that are, this is stills from a Swedish, quote, art film.
Well, art film. Art meant dirty when I was young, and that's the way it should stay. Inga was one of the Sweden, you know, the Bergman movies, when they first came out in Baltimore, were sold as sex films because they had a little bit of nudity in them. And Sweden became a code word for dirty. Still, the dirty bookshop in Baltimore is called the Sweden Bookshop. I'm not making this up. So I love the idea. I tried to put Inga in, but I just showed the back of somebody. I showed no nudity. I showed the one shot in a sex film that you would never reproduce, that would never become a still. It is the sexy girl walking away from you out of focus, a shot that no one would ever produce. All the stills in this show are ones that would never be produced. I did a whole series called Marks, where I just took photographs off the floor when I was making my movie Pecker of the tape marks that the crew puts down that the actors have to hit to stay in focus. And that's the only thing in the shot. Everything that would be in a movie is gone. The actors, the costumes, the props, and all that's left is the one thing you can't show in a movie still.
Since a few of the shots in your book allude to, you know, erotic movies or porn movies, I'm wondering how you discovered pornography as a kid.
Gee, how did I discover porn as a kid? Peyton Place was the first dirty book I had ever read, and I had heard about it, certainly. Mandingo was another one, and that's like kind of a great movie. And Playboy. I mean, Playboy was the first thing that you could ever really see. Now, gay porn was a very, very different thing. There was a store called Sherman's downtown that had those magazines like Vim and Vigor, and they were supposedly muscle man magazines, but it was kind of a coded thing. It was the first gay magazines I ever saw.
Did your father have pornographic books or men's magazines around that you could sneak peeks at?
No, he didn't. But he did have Peyton Place, and I did read his copy of Peyton Place. Everyone had Peyton Place. My grandfather had Peyton Place. Peyton Place was the biggest number one bestseller for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it led to Jackie Suzanne. It led to Jackie Collins. It led to that entire genre of work. But she did it first, and she did it best, and she had such great titles. Another one of her books was The Tight White Collar, about a priest. That's such a good title. But she didn't handle success so well. I mean, she divorced her husband, she moved to the Plaza Hotel, and she drank too much and died, basically. So that's not the best success story. But the book was so famous that when I went back to New Hampshire, where she wrote the book, they still talk mean about her there in the town. And the library only had one tattered copy. But I did go to her grave. And Grace has been a great heroine of mine.
When you started finding pornography, straight pornography, what was it like reading or seeing photos that were fetishizing women's bodies when women's bodies weren't what it was about for you?
Well, when I looked at those pictures, I always looked at it in a way to see how far it could go. The same way I went to heterosexual sexploitation movies all the time that had no male nudity to see how far it could go. I was interested in how the taboos would fall, how it started with nudist camp movies were the first things I saw, and you would see bare breasts on women and sometimes asses. But once in a while, a male ass. But they had to be playing volleyball, so, you know, that was not so erotic to me. I've never had a night where I'm that horny. Let's put it that way.
How did you get to see the nudist camp movies? And these were movies that ostensibly were supposed to be documentaries about healthy alternative lifestyles and so on. But they were really about the nudity. Where did they play? Where did you get to see them?
I can tell you right where. One of my favorite theaters, the Rex Movie Theater in Baltimore, which is now a church. When I was young, it started out in I saw The Wizard of Oz there. But it later became a nudie movie theater where I not only saw nudist camp movies, I saw the early Russ Meyer movies. I saw the Ghoulies and the Ruffies. And it was one man who owned it who fought the censorship board. We had the Maryland Censorship Board. And censorship has always been something I fought. So I've always dealt with censorship. So the Rex Theater was where I got a lot of my film education in Baltimore.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with filmmaker John Waters. The Baltimore Museum of Art, in his hometown, has just launched a 3-month retrospective exhibition of his visual art. It's called John Waters, Indecent Exposure, and runs through January 6th.
Did you ever feel guilty for your tastes that were about violating all the standards of decency?
No, I never felt guilty. I always knew. I told the story before, but when I was young, I heard my parents talking about me. You know, you listen at the top of the steps, and my mom said, well, he's just an odd duck. And I thought, well, that's it, you know? So I didn't really ever care that the other kids weren't interested in what I was in, because as long I had a very rich fantasy life. And my parents allowed that. I had a little stage even as a kid. My parents bought me a reel-to-reel tape recorder so I could tape songs. I was the first downloader ever because I, with a reel-to-reel tape recorder, tape songs off the radio. But then, so I could sing them all and lip-sync them, basically. So I was a puppeteer as a kid. I had a job. I had a career when I was 12 years old as a puppeteer. So I always had an outlet for this that was encouraged, even though the work I was doing was not exactly the work that they wished I was doing. But I guess they figured it was this or nothing, maybe, or prison. But they were very supportive, which was very, very, very encouraging. And I always say that. If you've got a kid that doesn't fit in, is rebelling in any way, encourage it. If your daughter comes home and she's just had her entire face tattooed, what can you do? Maybe she'll open a tattoo parlor that will do well. That's all you can do. You got to deal with what you got.
Since you didn't feel guilty about watching things and being obsessively interested in things that weren't supposed to be healthy, did you go the other direction and figure, well, I might as well play it up to the hilt and be, you know, take on the pose of the pervert?
No, I never thought of it that way. I had to create a persona for myself in the beginning when we made these movies because I didn't have any advertising. No one knew who I was. We had to think of a way to publicize the movies. And Divine and I did that sort of as I was the director and he was the insane movie star. And certainly I dressed weirdly, but it was always confusing. I never, my audience in the beginning was never gay or straight. It was gay people that didn't like other gay people. It was straight. It was hippies that didn't like hippies. It was always the outsider of another outsider group. That's what my audience began with. And certainly, I encourage that. But it seemed to work because, yes, in the beginning, underground movies, when I made them, they were made in a way to offend the very people who would come there, in a humorous way, though, always. By doing the whole Kennedy assassination, which we did, and Divine plays Jackie Kennedy, and it was shot in 1965 and came out in 66. Believe me, that was didn't go over very well at the time. But at the same time, it was a liberal taboo. I mean, I liked Kennedy. I loved Jacqueline Kennedy, or Jacqueline Kennedy is how she pronounced it. So I was always making fun of things that I really, really liked and respected.
Why don't you describe what you did in your version of the Kennedy assassination with Divine in the role of Jackie Kennedy?
Well, this was in a movie called Eat Your Makeup, and it's about people that kidnap models and force them to eat their makeup and model themselves to death. And Divine was not the star of it. He was a supporting player in it. And there's a scene where Divine is in drag, just weird drag, but with no wig on, because we were trying to even offend, I guess, drag queens at the time by not taking it seriously. And he starts looking through all these Jacqueline Kennedy magazines, where there were many of at the time, fan magazines, and he starts to imagine himself as Jacqueline Kennedy in the Kennedy assassination. And we have the whole thing, the cavalcade. I mean, a pitiful version. But we have the chauffeur. We have all the people that were in the car. We have Secret Service agents. And Divine is waving to the crowds. There are no crowds. It was filmed on my parents' street in Lutherville, Maryland, Morris Avenue. and then it is scored to a classical music where there's one note that is the gunshot. And then Divine crawls over the trunk of the car with the blood and everything. And it's quite graphic. But it was filmed so primitively, that's a nice way to say badly, black and white, 16 millimeter grainy, overexposed, that when I took pictures of it 25, 30 years later, it began to look like the real Zapruder film, one of the most famous 8 millimeter movies ever. So, I did a photo piece based on that, pictures of something I did a long time ago. And it goes around the wall, around a corner of the wall, because I always joke that I'm a carny. Well, I believe in the art world that the frame is the hype. The frame is the advertising campaign. So to me, it was too big for one wall. And it has to go around the wall.
And for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with Divine, who in this film that you're referring to played Jackie Kennedy, Divine was a very heavy man who usually played a woman in your movies and patterned himself in some of those roles on Elizabeth Taylor. And what did you think of real drag queens at the time?
Well, they were square at the time. You know, I think Divine helped make drag queens a lot hipper. They all wanted to be Bess Meyerson. They were really square. They weren't hip ever. Now all drag queens are hip. I mean, you see them at Wigstock, and they're all really funny, and they have a sense of humor, and they have funny names and everything. But then they were very, very serious. I remember in Philadelphia, there's a great movie called The Queen about a drag beauty contest in Philadelphia. I know where you live. And Harlow was the winner, and a very, very famous drag queen. But we used Elizabeth Coffey, who was at the time much more ludicrous and much more funny and had a sense of humor about it and used being a drag queen as being a comedy terrorist, which I think was much more useful in film than just a man trying to be a pretty woman.
Now, early in your career, you said that your work is really about the sadness normal people feel because they're not involved in show business.
Somebody said that was the snottiest thing I ever said. I didn't mean it to be snotty, but I believe that most everybody secretly imagines themselves in show business, and every day on their way to work, they're a little bit depressed because they're not. People are sad. They're not famous in America.
I guess you really needed to be famous.
Well, I certainly can't complain about it. I hate to hear people that are in show business that complain about any of that kind of thing. Well, what on earth did you pick that field to go in for if you didn't want people to recognize you? I've always said that show business is filled with the most insecure people of all, that we base a life on having to get approval of strangers from everything we do over and over and over on each project.
You know, in your book, there's lots of stills of movies and lots of stills from movies that were transgressive in their time or, you know, violating some taboo in some small way. You also have two...
Or failed.
Yeah. But you also have a couple of photos of Clarabelle, the clown from Howdy Doody. not known as the most... But. Okay, next to that.
Clarabelle.
Yes.
He was psychotic. Look at him. It was the first thing. And I was on the Howdy Doody show. My parents took me. I was on the Peanut Gallery at NBC Studios. Clarabelle was a psychotic clown who never spoke, who honked a horn and shot you in the face with seltzer water. And, you know, Captain Kangaroo and Clarabelle were the same person. Imagine that life. I think Clarabelle was... frightening in the best sense of the word. It was the first psychotic person I remember from my childhood, his character.
Did Bob Keeshan play Clarabelle?
Yes.
Ah, if I knew that, I'd forgotten.
There was a couple Clarabelles. Yes, he was the first Clarabelle.
Huh. So was that your first brush with real show business, being in the Peanut Gallery of the Heavy Duty show?
And I saw it was fake. It was all a lie. And rather than be the disillusioned child, I was in on the secret, and I wanted to stay in on it.
So you did puppet shows as a kid?
Yeah, for a long time.
What kind of characters?
Well, hand puppets, and I did Cinderella, and then later Punch and Judy. But at the end, I would come out from behind the stage, which is like breaking the third wall of puppetry, and say to the kids, you know, stick out your hand, and the dragon puppet will bite it for good luck. 3/4 of the kids cheered, and they loved it, and go crazy. The rest of them had nervous breakdowns and started sobbing. And this is basically what I still do.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. After a break, we'll listen to another conversation with Waters about his book, Role Models. And I'll review The Romanoffs, the first TV series from Matt Weiner since he created Mad Men. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music featured in the John Waters film Polyester, performed by the Ray Bryant Combo.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Maine Office of Tourism, offering travelers an opportunity to explore and discover their very own Maine thing, to be inspired, be original, and be yourself at visitmaine.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, working to outsmart cancer through the use of genomic testing to profile each individual's cancer and reveal possible treatment options. Learn more about precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with another of Terry's interviews with John Waters. This was in 2010, when Waters had just written a book called Role Models, about the people who have inspired him. The sources of his inspirations also are at the center of a new retrospective of his visual art, presented in his hometown by the Baltimore Museum of Art. That exhibition, called John Waters' Indecent Exposure, opened last Sunday and runs through January 6th. In his book, Role Models, John Waters named some of the people who had inspired him and explained why. Some, like Tennessee Williams, weren't that surprising, but others were. Like one of the female former followers of Charles Manson, or like popular 50s singing star Johnny Mathis.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm in love with you. Just because my...
John Waters, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really great to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me again.
So I'm going to start by asking you to read from the first chapter of Role Models, and this chapter is about Johnny Mathis, who was... shockingly, one of your role models. So why don't you read an excerpt of that for us?
I wish I were Johnny Mathis. So mainstream, so popular, so unironic, yet perfect. Effortlessly boyish at over 70 years old, with a voice that still makes all of America want to make out. Heavenly, warm. Yes, I'll say it out loud. Wonderful, wonderful. Is it because Johnny Mathis is the polar opposite of me? A man whose greatest hits album was on the Billboard charts for 490 consecutive weeks versus me, a cult filmmaker whose core audience, no matter how much I've crossed over, consists of minorities who can't even fit in with their own minorities? Do we secretly idolize our imagined opposites?
That's John Waters reading from his new book, Role Models. I was shocked to see that Johnny Mathis was like the lead chapter.
He probably was too.
Well, I mean, he's, as a singer, he's such a, like a romantic. And you're so not in your art. I can't speak about your private life. So what is the attraction to him?
Well, because Johnny Mathis is the opposite of me. Because Johnny Mathis to me... is the kind of mainstream that I will never, ever be able to have. And everybody wants to have hits like that. But at the same time, Johnny Mathis said to me, I always wanted to be a jazz singer. So in a way, your opposite sometimes isn't exactly what you believe him to be, too. So I didn't know Johnny Mathis. And to get to meet him was not easy because I'm sure they Googled me and I'd be nervous, too. So he was lovely, though, when I went to his house and everything.
So I always assumed that the reason why Johnny Mathis didn't do a lot of interviews was because he was in the closet and didn't want to have to speak
about that. Well, I wrote to him
about that.
Saying that I was not coming to him with any agenda, sexist, moral, racial, anything. And I didn't. And I didn't. And I never asked him those questions. I don't really think, obviously, if he wanted to talk about any of his personal life, he did. He just said some of my fans think they're Mrs. Johnny Mathis. You know, and I know what he meant. What does he have to share his public life with? I'm not always for that. You know, I get weary of reading these people that tell every personal thing to reporters they just met that day. And that's when I realized they don't have friends. That's what friends are for, not reporters.
So you mentioned Tennessee Williams. He's a chapter in your book, Role Models. And I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of your chapter on Tennessee Williams.
Okay, this one is called, The Kindness of Strangers.
Let me just say, this is John Waters, who is my guest. His new book is called Role Models, and each chapter is about somebody else who, in one way or another, was a role model or an inspiration for him. So this is Tennessee Williams.
Years later, Tennessee Williams saved my life. The first time I went to a gay bar, I was 17 years old. It was called The Hut, and it was in Washington, D.C. Some referred to it as the Chicken Hut, and it was filled with early 1960s gay men in fluffy sweaters who cruised one another by calling table to table on phones provided by the bar. I may be queer, but I ain't this, I remember thinking. Still reading everything Tennessee Williams wrote, I knew he would understand my dilemma. Tennessee never seemed to fit the gay stereotype, even then, and sexual ambiguity and turmoil were always made appealing and exciting in his work. My type doesn't know who I am, he stated, according to legend, and even if the sex lives of his characters weren't always healthy, they certainly seemed hearty. Tennessee Williams wasn't a gay cliché, so I had the confidence to try to not be one myself. Gay was not enough. It was a good start, however.
So he gave you confidence to be gay but not fit a stereotype of gay. What were some of the other...
He gave me the confidence to be a beatnik, really, to be a gay beatnik, or to be a beatnik who was gay. That's very different. You know, you went into a field of all different kinds of rebels. And their sexuality was always still my friends. It doesn't matter if they're gay or straight. If I'm friendly with somebody, that has literally no interest to me whether I like the person or not. And I'm always amazed by people that say, oh, you should go with this agent. He has all gay people. Well, why would I go with him? Like saying he has all black people. Are they good? Are they bad? I mean, that's what counts. So I always liked the gay people that had trouble even fitting in the gay stereotype because I don't like rules of any kind. And I seek people that break them with happiness and not bringing pain to themselves.
So how have you changed in terms of what you want to do with your fame and with people's interest in your life? Because in some ways you've turned yourself into your art, you know, because you do shows, one-man shows, you've written more personally, you know, over the years, and people are dying to hear about you.
Well, I don't know. I use my own personality to find out about others. My personality is why probably Johnny Mathis let me in the house, or why the outsider pornographers I left in the house let me in and trusted me. And I think I've only written about people that I look up to, that have, even if they've had terrible things happen in their life, because they've had a more extreme life than I've ever had. And I respect people. I, as a writer, every day think, what would it like to be that person? And if you're a journalist or a writer, you get to be that person. Wouldn't everybody like to barge in people's house and ask them personal questions? I don't get why everybody doesn't want to do that. But when you're writing a book, you're allowed to do that. That's acceptable. And that's why people tell me everything. On airplanes, strangers confide in me the most deepest, darkest secrets. And I think because they think I'll understand. And I generally do understand. I've taught in prison. I've counseled people. I actually would be a good defense lawyer. I would be a good counselor. I would be a good shrink, actually. And I believe in all those things. I've been arrested. I've been to the psychiatrist. So I think you have to participate in whatever business it in you are trying to be involved in.
So getting back to Tennessee Williams, you've read all of his books, and you've read all of lots of people's books. You collect books. You have over 8,400 books, all cataloged.
I like to read books. I don't collect books. Sometimes people say they collect books and they don't read them.
Yes.
I like to read. People always say to me, how can you read so much? And I say, easy. You don't have a boyfriend or girlfriend, and you don't watch television. It's simple. You'll read all the time. And I'm on airplanes all the time. So I love to read. It's how I relax. I don't find that a compulsion. Cataloging them is being nice to my heirs.
Do you have heirs?
Of course. As much of a control freak as I am, you don't think I have my death plotted? I even know where I'm going to be buried. We all bought plots, a lot of my friends, where it's like People's Temple graveyard.
Well, I know, and you say that is it the same cemetery that Divine
yes.
is in?
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't mind asking, why do you want to be buried?
Because I love the idea of graveyards. I like people visiting. I used to go in graveyards when I was young, and Divine would steal flowers for parties. We'd have a couple beers. I like the atmosphere. I like the worms go in, the worms go out. I believe in the resurrection, the only thing I've been ever taught that sounds like a good idea. But then I panic about real estate prices and what are we supposed to wear and are we nude? So I go into that in the book, my paranoia about the recession.
You're the only person I've ever asked that to who wants to be buried because, like, you really like graveyards.
Oh, yeah. I do like graveyards. A lot of people like graveyards. They're peaceful. They're quiet. And we're all going to be buried, so all our friends can have one-stop shopping. You know, if you want to come, you can say hi, Mink, hi to everybody around. And I like the idea of it. It's and my mother, at first, I thought it would be strange to tell my own family because my mother said, I think it's a great idea because not your sister's going to be buried where her husband is, you know. So I like the idea.
Did your parents feel bad that you're not getting buried next to
no,
them?
No, they didn't. I was afraid to tell them, and they thought it was a fine idea. They totally understood. I went to the graveyard where he is buried, and
where Divine is buried?
My father.
Oh, your father's buried.
And they quoted me prices that I didn't know. I never bought a grave, but it sounded like a ripoff to me. And they showed me, like, tombs, like they thought Rudolph Valentino was coming out there they were going to sell to. And I thought, wait a minute. So I went and asked the woman where Divine is because I liked the little graveyard, and she told me a price. I said, I'll take a double. I got, like, a lot of room around me, too, because the price was quite fair.
Two bathrooms?
Yeah. It's like a two-bedroom.
So have you thought through, like, what kind of, like, tombstone you
oh,
want?
Oh, yes. I kind of want it to be modeled after Pasolini's. And I want mine to just say, my father's is the same, and I didn't realize it until I saw it recently, his graveyard, because he only died a few years ago. Just say, John S. Waters, Jr., the day I was born, the day I was died. Who wants to risk a joke that has to last eternity? Humor changes. Talk about an old joke. If it was on your, I think it's the only time it should be quite simple on your gravestone.
What's on Divine's stone?
Praying hands, but his parents put his real name and Divine on it, which was quite loving.
Uh-huh.
And people, oh my God, they write stuff all over it, and they leave stuff and leave donuts and dresses, and it's visited quite a lot.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of local pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2010 interview with filmmaker John Waters. A major exhibition of his visual work is presented through January 6th at the Baltimore Museum of Art. It's called John Waters: Indecent Exposure. It explores his artistic influences, as does the book he and Terry were discussing at the time, which was titled Role Models.
So let's get to somebody else in the book, and this is Ray Kawakubo. Thank you. And he's a designer.
She's a woman. Yeah.
She's a designer, yeah. Mm-hmm. who was not known to me.
She's pretty famous. She did Comme des Garçons, one of the first Japanese fashion labels that deconstructed fashion. She's been around quite some time, hugely successful in Japan.
Okay, you describe your look as disaster at the dry cleaners.
Yeah, I like her clothes. She always has something the matter with it. So I love the idea. When you spend more money than you should on an outfit for fashion, no one thinks you spent money. They think you got it for a nickel somewhere in a thrift shop. But actually, since it's on purpose, it's like getting dressed in reverse. It's sneaky fashion. It's wearing outfits that you like that regular people just think is something the matter with it, and you got a bad coat on. I mean, I see people on the street that are homeless that actually look like outfits that I've paid a lot of money for. And I find that delightful. I find it delightful. My father used to say, you bought that something. They saw you coming, boy. But they did see me coming, and I was eager to get it.
Okay, this is far too personal.
Yes.
So I'll try it anyways. Do you like costuming when it comes to actual sex?
No. You mean does someone have to be in a certain outfit? No, I'm not that specific. Thank God. But what somebody has on, I always really think that if boys turn their belt halfway to the right, like so the buckle is in on the side, Marlon Brando did that, Joe D'Alessandro did that. It's a look of confidence I like. I like somebody that pulls off an effortless look. But no, I don't have to have somebody dressed as an airline pilot or that kind of that. No, that does, I would start laughing.
That's what I was wondering. Is there something that's inherently absurd at some point?
Everyone's sex life is funny except your own.
Uh-huh.
Really, it is. Every person's is. And yours never is.
Why is that?
Well, because the lengths that people go to and the extremes and the conditions and the mental exercises and guilt and shame and the happiness that everybody goes through and what they'll do for sex is never-ending and mind-boggling and very interesting to me. And I don't think a lot of times people choose any of it. A friend of mine, I think I have it in this book, where... her mother had Alzheimer's, and she for years, so she knows a lot about Alzheimer's, the community. And I said, well, ask them, do people forget if they're gay or straight? And the worker said, never once. They don't know who their family is. They don't wreck anybody's. But no one suddenly doesn't remember if they're gay or straight. Well, doesn't that prove, really, that you're born that way?
Okay, so I want to quote something you say in the book. You talk a little bit about being in therapy, and you say, a psychiatrist once told me early in treatment, stop trying to make me like you. And what a sobering welcome smack in the face that statement was. Yet, somehow, every day of my life is still a campaign for popularity, or better yet, a crowded funeral.
Well, isn't everybody in show business under the same thing, that they're insecure people that have to go into a field that where strangers have to tell them they're good for the rest of their life? I figured that out a long time ago. Yes, I thought it was a great thing when the shrink said that. I'm not there to make friends. You're supposed to talk about the things that make you the most uncomfortable. I'm paying for this. Let's get my money's worth. So I used to, after that, go in and think of the things that made me the most uptight to talk about, which is what you're supposed to do with a psychiatrist. I believe in the talking cure. You know, Freud said the best thing ever, that line that's, I think, so brilliant, is turning hysterical misery into common unhappiness. What a great, great line.
But I find it such a paradox in what you spelled out there, that you're the person who has, like, defied every convention in your life and in your art. The person who you say, even you're a minority group, you're an outsider of. I mean, you turn that into an art and a career, and yet you try to get your psychiatrist to love you, and you say that every day in your life is a campaign for popularity. Isn't that a paradox?
No, I think it's probably being a healthy neurotic. Everything that I'm trying to be.
Healthy neurotic.
Yeah,
only paradoxically enough.
But only a neurotic cares if everyone likes them, you know. And in show business, certainly, it is politics. It's all the same thing. You have to get people to like you. By writing books, by making movies and everything, I think you're continuing to do that. And a crowded funeral is a nice thing. I like that. But the older you get, the less chance that has of happening. That's another reason to make younger friends. So they can fill in, like at the Oscars, when somebody goes to the bathroom, they have somebody that sits in the seat. I want them at the funeral.
You know, because as you've said, you've made a living selling shock.
Surprise, I think.
Surprise, yeah. And some of your films, particularly some of your early films, like Pink Flamingos, have some very, like, vile, repulsive thinking people in them.
Mm. I don't know that I totally agree, but okay.
Okay.
They were certainly using anarchy to get their point across, and they were rebelling against their particular worlds at the time and lusting after things that maybe you shouldn't. But I think the morals in all my films were quite obvious, and the good guy won in every one of the movies.
Nevertheless, I think people are really surprised by how just kind of like nice and funny and easy to talk to you are, like earlier in your career, before there was as public a John Waters as there is now. I think people thought that you would be this really peculiar person who might really traffic in filth. And
in the old days, they did. Yeah, I used to show up at colleges, and they'd have a pound of marijuana in the car for me. Please, please. I don't want to do this. I think in the beginning. But I think through writing books maybe more, and more of my public speaking and stuff, is that they realize that I'm not the characters I think of. But no director is usually that. Not that many of Stephen King go out there and do that. I mean, why do they think I would?
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's always really great to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. The Baltimore Museum of Art has just opened a major retrospective of his visual art and published a hefty companion volume. Both are called John Waters, Indecent Exposure, and the exhibition runs through January 6th. Coming up, I review The Romanoffs, the new TV series from Matt Weiner, the creator of Mad Men. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. Matt Weiner, the creator of the period drama series Mad Men, hasn't produced a follow-up project for TV since that acclaimed drama series left the AMC network in 2015. Until now. Today, on the Amazon Prime Video streaming service, Weiner unveils his newest effort, an 8-episode anthology drama series called The Romanoffs. The rollout plan for The Romanoffs is unusual for Amazon, just as the drama series itself is an unusual experiment for the show's creator, Matt Weiner. Instead of making the entire season of The Romanoffs available at once, as it does with so many of its exclusive TV series, Amazon Prime Video presents only the first 2 episodes today as the series premieres. Subsequent installments will be doled out weekly, as they are on broadcast TV. And unlike the past 2 drama series on which Weiner worked, his own Mad Men and David Chase's The Sopranos, this new series does not tell a continuing story. It's an 8-episode anthology drama. But where such modern anthologies as FX's Fargo and HBO's True Detective tell a new story with a new cast every season, The Romanoffs is an anthology series in the purest sense. Like The Twilight Zone or Alfred Hitchcock Presents, or such live Golden Age drama anthologies as Playhouse 90 and Studio One, each episode of The Romanoffs stands alone. Mad Men was a novel, delivering 1 chapter a week. The Romanoffs is a collection of short stories, distributed on the same schedule. Each episode looks at a different person who is, or claims to be, a descendant of the infamous Romanoff clan, the Tsar and his family who were killed by Bolsheviks during the Russian Revolution of 1918. The stories Weiner tells here, as writer or co-writer and as director of every episode, are set in the modern day, but in various locations around the world. I've previewed only the first 2 episodes, which isn't enough to deliver a final verdict on the series as a whole. But some judgments certainly can be made. Both of the opening movie-length installments are sharply written, compellingly performed, and confidently directed. They're beautifully photographed. And just like anthology shows ought to do, they go in unexpected directions, because none of these characters or actors have to show up for the next episode. And there are some episode-specific quirks as well. The opening installment, The Violet Hour, is set in Paris and features a surprising amount of dialogue in French with English subtitles. And the second episode, The Royal We, manages to turn into some weird sort of mixture of 12 Angry Men and The Love Boat, and, improbably, features more cigarette smoking than Mad Men ever did. The Romanoffs announces its intention to shake things up and go its own way immediately, by starting with a polite instrumental opening theme that shifts suddenly into the defiant lyrics of Tom Petty's Refugee. The first story features Marta Keller, who starred opposite Dustin Hoffman in Marathon Man back in the 70s, as Anushka, an elderly woman living in a Romanoff family apartment in Paris. She's a pampered, secluded racist, whose attitude and outbursts make it impossible for her to hang on to her hired help for long. As her nephew Greg, played by Aaron Eckhart, points out when she phones him to object to the newest housekeeper he sends as a replacement, a young Muslim woman.
Bonjour, ma belle. Comment ça va aujourd'hui?
C'est une abomination. Une monstruosité.
What are you talking about?
There's been a mistake. Je ne veux pas de ça ici.
Je ne comprends pas.
I need a caregiver and not a terrorist.
They emailed me her references. She's educated. She's studying to be a nurse. She knows CPR, first aid.
You know about this?
So you want the other one back?
The whore? I'm so afraid. Stay with me on the phone.
What do you want me to do? You've been through everybody else there. She's the best caregiver they have, and you are by far the worst client.
The second episode, with an entirely different cast of characters, is set in more familiar American ground. Corey Stahl and Carrie Bechet play a couple going through the motions in a stifling marriage. Before long, they embark on adventures that lead to unanticipated new possibilities. He on jury duty, she on a cruise ship. But before that, he's stuck working in a strip mall at a test preparation storefront where his college-bound clients have some very lofty goals regarding their potential SAT scores and their college admission targets.
I need a 1600. I want to go to Harvard. What would you say if I told you there might be other options that are better for you?
I would say I want my money back because you have a guaranteed satisfaction policy.
Okay. So can you tell me why you want to go to Harvard?
So I can do whatever I want instead of staying here forever and getting a shitty job and being a loser.
Uh-huh. Because people who stay here are losers.
Well, I don't know. You help people get into Harvard. It's pretty cool.
I can give you your money back right now because wanting something and getting it are two very different things.
Not if you go to Harvard.
Keep saying Harvard, Andrew. It's not going to make it happen. You have to accept the reality and try to be happy with whatever you get.
Yale?
You're not listening, Andrew. The big secret is nobody's happy.
Well, I'm happy because The Romanoffs is another modern series, like Fargo and American Crime Story, that is bringing back the best elements of what the classic old anthology series used to provide. I don't know quite what the rest of Matt Weiner's new series has in store, except that its upcoming stars include Christina Hendricks, Isabel Huppert, Diane Lane, and Paul Reiser. But I'm looking forward to it, in part because not knowing what to expect is more than half the fun. On Monday's show...
What up, home slices of Teed Up Queens? It's your girl, Phoebes, here.
Phoebe Robinson, stand-up comedian, writer, actress, co-creator and co-host of the podcast and TV show Two Dope Queens, and co-host of the podcast So Many White Guys. She has a new book titled Everything's Trash, But It's Okay. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzville. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancourt.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to bringing the traveler closer to the destination by river and by sea, offering a small ship experience with a shore excursion included in every port. Learn more at vikingcruises.com. And from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions, with a network of more than 7,000 independent installers. TireRack.com. Helping drivers find, deliver, install.